you have a Bible, open to 2 Samuel chapter 18. We're going to pick up our study here. 2 Samuel chapter 18. And we're going to go chapter 18 to chapter 19, verse 8. If you don't have a Bible and you need to use the one in the pew, it's page 251. Page 251. So why don't you turn over there? While you're going to 2 Samuel 18, let me ask this question. What image, what idea, what situation comes to your mind when I say the word bittersweet? Bittersweet, kind of like the chocolate, bittersweet. Grammatically, bittersweet is an adjective. It's something that is pleasant, but including or marked by elements of suffering or regret. That's the grammatical definition. Practically, bittersweet feels like an oxymoron. Two things that really shouldn't go together, that get put together, things like jumbo shrimp, right? Army intelligence, right? Government efficiency, smart Democrat. Did I go there? Kind Republican. Okay, so we're happy. Everyone's offended. An oxymoron. Doesn't seem like this should go together, but it does. Forrest Gump famously said, life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you get inside. If 2 Samuel 18 and 19 has anything to say about it, it would say, life is like a box of bittersweet chocolate. You'll always get one with the other. Something good, often marked by suffering or regret. And there's no better word to describe 2 Samuel 18 to the early part of 19 than the word bittersweet. This morning, we're going to look at four bittersweet realities. Number one, a bittersweet beginning, a bittersweet battle, a bittersweet report, and a bittersweet end. Now, if you're familiar with the structure of 2 Samuel, we've been studying it long enough, maybe you've been doing some reading as well, you know that the narrative arc really ends at chapter 20, for all intents and purposes, which means we're really at the very end of the David story. Now, you might be looking, well, wait a minute, but there's still more chapters 21 and 24. Yeah, that's because those chapters serve as an epilogue or an appendix to the Samuel history that he's recorded. And so we'll look at that as well. But for all intents and purposes, the main narrative arc ends in chapter 20, which means we're very close to wrapping up David's story. Next week, we'll look at the majority of chapter 19, where he just goes back to Jerusalem and takes the throne again officially in that category, in that capacity. And then chapter 20, kind of deja vu, there's yet another rebellion against them that which he has to quell and kind of rinse and repeat. That's how his story ends. In reality, it's kind of a bittersweet ending to his reign. David is seated as king. All rivals to his throne, all threats to his throne has been dealt with, but it's not as satisfying as we'd like. During staff meeting, Vika was sitting there and she was talking about the reading service from last week and she was like, "Yeah," she goes, I love the word of God and all that, and don't get me wrong, but man, just longing for this. I'm longing for something more. Can we get into like a gospel or something? Because this is kind of hard. And to which we're sitting around the table going, that's exactly the point. That's the feeling we leave these books with. We leave the David narrative still wanting a better king and still longing for a better kingdom. When you think about it, I mean, you go to this day in Jerusalem and people are still mourning at the tomb of David. David is the height of human governance, the pinnacle of human integrity and rule, and yet we're still wanting something better. We're still wanting something more. Sadly, bittersweet is all that we can seem to hope for in this life. And actually, that's a good reminder to us, isn't it? Especially during an election year, right? Is that if you really want true justice and righteousness, no matter who gets voted in, or which administration gets voted in, or which administration steals the election, wherever you are on that spectrum, you will be longing for something better, no matter who gets in. If you truly want true justice and righteousness. Now, don't get me wrong, there's still reason to hope in 2 Samuel. After all, like I said a few weeks ago, the David of old is back, right? But David is old. At least at this point, he's older. And that's the first bittersweet reality that begins our study. So let's take a look at it. Let me read. You should be at 2 Samuel 18 by this point. Here we go. Then David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. That's just kind of typical military parlance for how he's organizing his forces. And David sent out the army one third under the commander of Joab, or the command of Joab, one third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. You remember Ittai, who was just a faithful friend to David, and he's being rewarded now. He's kind of moving up in the ranks here. And the king said to the men, I myself will also go out with you. But the men said, you shall not go out. For if we flee, they will not care about us. If half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better that you send us help from the city. Verse 4, the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood at the side of the gate. That's important to remember. So the king stood at the side of the gate while all the army marched out by hundreds and by thousands. Now, obviously, there is just some practical wisdom in the king staying behind because, as we know, David is no longer the spry, young, fierce warrior of his youth. At this stage of the game, he's probably in his mid-50s, late 50s. And for that time period, and given the life he's led, that he's an old man. In fact, in 2 Samuel 21, if you want to read ahead, there is a narrative where David almost gets killed in battle. And his men just say, okay, enough's enough. You are not coming out anymore and doing this. So here again, he stays behind, although David wants to go into the battle. It's as if the narrator wants us to realize that the apathy that once gripped David, that remember gripped him in 2 Samuel 11, that made him stay behind from the battle, that got him into the whole mess to begin with, it's as if the narrator wants us to see that apathy is gone. David is back, and even old in age, he wants to pick up the sword and go into battle. This is the David of old that we love, that inspired us, that challenged us, that encouraged us. But he listens to his men wisely. And so in verse 4, he stands at the side of the gate while his men march on to fight his battle. It's a bittersweet reality. It's one that we all have to admit. That no matter how successful, no matter how strong, how beautiful, how fierce, how powerful you were when you were young, none of us can resist the slow march of time that eventually robs us of all these things. And we see that happening even here with David. But verse 5 reveals to us probably what David's maybe stronger motivation actually was in this situation. Look at verse 5. And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom. So yes, he wanted to go out and fight. He wanted to do that. But we also see David had an alternative motive. Who can blame him? This is my son. And I want to make sure he comes back from this. Yes, he's the rebel. Yes, he's the enemy. Yes, he's the usurper. But he's my son, and I want him brought back. But here is the bittersweet reality that hangs over our entire passage, and this is it. The reality is God will bring his blessings back to David for sure. But the means by which God will bring his blessings back will seem like anything but blessings to David. And you'll see exactly what I mean as we continue to study our text. So let's look at the next point. Let me read this one. It's a bit long. A bittersweet battle, picking the narrative up in verse 6. I'm going to read from 6 all the way down to 18. So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss there was great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went out under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head got caught fast in the oak, and he was suspended between heaven and earth while the mule that was under him went on. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." Joab said to the man who told him, "What, you saw him? Why then did you not strike him there to the ground?" ever the pragmatic, mercurial, shrewd, dangerous person, his king, his uncle, tells him, save my son. But here we see Joab, and quite frankly, thinking of the kingdom, he realizes there's only a way to secure the kingdom for sure, and that's to get rid of this man. See what he does next. Joab says to the man who told him, why you saw him, why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. Basically, that's an entire year's salary and a signet of honor. But the man said to Joab, even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. On the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. And Joab said, I will not waste time like this with you. And he took 3 javelins in his hand and thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. It's a brutal way to get rid of him. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, everyone to his own home. Now Absalom, in his lifetime, had taken and set up for himself the pillar that is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. Now, real quick, some of you really good students of Scripture are going, wait a minute. There's a little discrepancy in the Scriptures here, because chapter 14, verse 27, says that Absalom had 3 sons, and now he says he's got no sons. Well, more than likely, because none of the sons were named in chapter 14, historians believe that his 3 sons died in infancy or in early childhood. And so by the time he sets up this monument, he says, I have no sons. So that's what's going on there, if you recognize that discrepancy. Also, for those of you, if you've been to Jerusalem, the monument in the Kidron Valley called Absalom's Monument, that was made in the Herodian period, Rome. So that's not the same thing going on here. Let's get back to the text. So what we have here, civil war, right? This is a major crisis in the life of Israel. We haven't seen this except for the early chapters of 2 Samuel decades earlier. This is a massive situation. Yet here's my question. How many verses are dedicated to this civil war? Just 3, actually. Verses 6, 7, and 8. So just 3 verses to talk about this massive civil war, yet 23 verses to talk about how Absalom met his end and David's concern and grief over the situation. If you're a note taker, so chapter 18, verse 9 through 18, we read that. And then chapter 18, verse 24 into 19, verse 4, we'll look at that in a little bit. So here's a Bible study tip. Whatever you think might be the important thing in a text, pay attention to what the author is paying attention to. And the civil war is pretty significant, but he gives 3 verses to that, and he gives 23 verses between Absalom and David. What's the point? Friends, the monarchy is at stake. But at the end of the day, this is a story about a father and a son. But not just any father and son. This is God's anointed king and his rebel son. So on the one hand, what we're looking at is you have big redemptive historical realities at play. After all, Israel is a picture of God's rule to the world. And we see this, especially in Solomon's reign. Israel is to be the picture of this is what life is like under the good reign of God, which, by the way, as New Covenant believers, that's what the church is. Just a little side note there. So Israel is supposed to play that role. So the world can look and say, this is what it's like under God's command, under God's rule. And David himself, a picture of God's Christ, God's anointed one. Yet at the same time, this is just a really intimate story of a father and son and how their lives are impacted by what God is doing. And friends, in the same way, this is still true of how God works today. God's big plans often worked out in our little lives. And to be honest with you, where one begins and the other ends, I don't know. It's not very clear most times. So yes, you might be a member of this small local church, But the church is God's redemptive plan to reach the world, and you play a role in that. Yeah, you might be just a barista at Starbucks or a mid-tier software programmer, right? But service with honor, work with excellence, testifies to his character, and you bring him glory. Guys, the Christian life is always going to be a combination of the eternal and the temporal, the majestic and the mundane, the glorious and the grind. We can never forget that. All of our lives, guys, is ministry. You don't step into moments of ministry because now you're part of some activity or program at the church. You live in it every moment. And whether God uses you to bring revival or God uses you to change diapers, his glory is made manifest in the way you attend to those two things. And so we see that happening in here. And that's always the way God works. God's big plan in our little lives all the time. Well, let's get back to our text here. So this is a great victory. Don't get me wrong, right? It's a great victory for King David. But look at the cost. Look at verse 7. 20,000 lives lost. These were Israelites. This is a bittersweet victory indeed. But if the author, the narrator, is not so caught up with the civil war, then let's give our attention to the thing that he actually gives his attention to. And what that is the intersection of two verses we've looked at before. Number one, 2 Samuel 12, 10. Oh, I got the verses backwards. 2 Samuel 10, 11, 10 and 11. Sorry about that. Where Nathan says to David, "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house. I will raise up evil against you out from your own house." What we're seeing in our passage, this is the kind of the concluding arc of that judgment upon David so long ago that Nathan had proclaimed and even showing from his own house that this would come. So this is kind of concluding that particular arc. And at the same time, it's fulfilling what we learned about a couple of weeks ago from 2 Samuel 17, where the Lord says, "For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom." So this chapter, the role it plays, is it kind of concludes the arc of God's judgment on David for his sin, as well as answers how the Absalom rebellion gets taken care of. Right, so it serves those two purposes. Now, we know the reason God brought his judgment upon David, so that made sense, but why is God judging Absalom? Well, because in the Torah, Deuteronomy 27, 16 says, "A man who rebels and dishonors his father or mother is cursed." And then a few verses later in verse 20, it says, "A man who lays with his father's wife will be cursed." Absalom had done both. And although Absalom has with him a large army to protect him as necessary, he has a fast means of escape not afforded to all the other soldiers in that he has this mule. Now, I know when you hear mule, you kind of think maybe donkey, maybe slow, but no, these were much more swift of steed than you might think. So he had an army. He had this fast means of escape. He had all these things to protect him, yet he couldn't escape God's judgment. Friends, Galatians 6, 7 says, "Do not be deceived. What a man sows, a man reaps." God cannot be mocked. And Absalom made himself a curse to God, and he thought he could get away with it, and he was wrong. In verse 17, we hear about Absalom's burial, and he's buried as an accursed man is buried under just a heap of rocks, basically. You recall Joshua chapter 7, Achan, who disobeyed the command of God, and when they found out, they stoned him and buried him under a heap of stones. Or the king of Ai in Joshua chapter 8, he's buried under a heap of stones. Or the five kings in Joshua 10, they're hung up, their bodies are hung up, and then they're thrown and covered with a bunch of stones. This was a sign of disgrace. You didn't even have time to bury somebody. You just throw rocks on top of them. What an end for Absalom compared to the note we get about verse 18, what he wanted his legacy to be. He had built a monument so that people would remember Absalom, the king. He wanted a monument to his glory. He got a pile of shame. Such is the end of all those who set themselves as Antichrist. Because that is exactly what Absalom is. Absalom is an Antichrist. Christ is the Greek word for the Hebrew term Messiah, which simply means anointed one, which is what David is, God's anointed one. Absalom, friends, in many ways represents all the ways the world is at odds with God and his anointed. You think of chapter 14 and Absalom's vanity. You think of chapter 15 and his hubris and his pride and his deceit. You think of chapter 16 and his rebellion. And the world, and all those who put their hope, their trust, they put their lot in with it, will meet with the same end as Absalom. Seeking their own glory, forgotten under a pile of rubble. In his famous book, Democracy in America, de Tocqueville, I can't pronounce French names very well, writes about the insatiable lust that Americans have. He's not really trying to be, it's not really a critique, but it's a statement of fact, the insatiable lust that Americans have for the things of this world. This is what he writes. Men easily attain a certain equality of condition, but they can never attain as much as they desire. It perpetually retreats before them, yet without hiding itself from their sight, and in retreating draws them on. So in other words, he says, they can't satisfy the desire for more, and every time they kind of go after it, it keeps backing away, and that doesn't hide themselves. It just keeps themselves in sight, but keeps backing away. At every moment, they think they're about to grasp it. It escapes at every moment from their hold. They are near enough to see its charms, but too far enough to enjoy them. And before they have fully tasted its delights, they die. He wrote that many years ago, but I think he could describe modern life we live in today. Our insatiable lust for more glory usually ends up deceiving us, and we end up under a pile of rubble. Bertrand Russell, in a more academic way, said the same thing. All the labors of the ages, Russell is the great anti-Christian, you could say. All the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. And the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Sounds as if he's familiar with 2 Samuel 18. De Tocqueville, Russell, this isn't anything new. John the Apostle said something very similar. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world, and the world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. Friends, Absalom is a picture of the world and all those who ignore or rebel against God's anointed. And as we look back at the text, there is no shortage of irony in Absalom's death. Look at verse 9. And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Now, first, we assume that it's probably Absalom's pride. You remember chapter 14, his wonderful, beautiful locks that were his downfall as his hair gets and his head gets caught in the oak branches. Possibly what's happening, he's running from the enemy, and at the exact moment he looks behind, his hair, his head gets entangled, fearing that he's going to get scalped. He's kind of wrestling with it, and while he's wrestling with it, the mule runs away. So it's ironic that the very thing that we know about him, his Fabio looks, is what brings him down. Secondly, there's an irony in the mule running away. As I said, you may know from Zechariah, the mule was the designated mount of royalty. So here's his symbol of kingship, his fledgling kingship, running away from him, leaving him suspended between heaven and earth. Raised up high, but not high enough. The words of the man in verse 10 are theologically potent. He says, I saw Absalom hanging. The Hebrew word behind hanging is only used one other time in the Old Testament, and that's in Deuteronomy 21:23, to declare that anyone hanged on a tree is cursed by God. And finally, like his army, Absalom is devoured or beaten by the forest. Did you see that in verse 8? It said that the forest devoured more men than the sword. Probably what this means is that the terrain, wild animals, the wolves, the ibex, whatever it might be, the dense forest impeded troop movement, whatever it might be, it made it difficult and they lost to the more experienced servants of David. But at the same time, I'm not going to bypass the fact there might be some Lord of the Rings tree beard action going on here, right? Now, I know you rationalist people, you post-enlightenment wise people are saying, that's so silly. There's no such thing as miracles. Well, there are. And the Bible doesn't say one way or the other. I'm not saying the trees ate the men, okay? But I'm not saying that. I'm just saying the text says the forest devoured more men than the sword. And there's a rational part of me that wants to explain that. Yes, the terrain, the animal life, the dense forest, troop impediment, get that. But if I'm also going to realize that God often intervenes in amazing ways and crazier ways than this, yeah, I could see a forest munching on a man or two. It's possible. Either way, Absalom's fate is a perfect example of what Scripture says. The forest devoured David's enemies. And Absalom serves as a cautionary tale for anyone who seeks to live their lives against God's anointed, against God's Christ, be it David or David's greater son, Jesus Christ. So that's the battle. Let's look to the report. Friends, I'm going to run late. Sorry, I'm looking at my watch. I'm going to run late, but that's okay. It's been a while. Verse 19 is the verse. We finally get the theological understanding, the interpretation of what's going on. Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, let me run and carry this great news to the king. Here it is. The Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies. We see the same interpretation, verse 31, on the lips of the Cushite. And the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, good news, shalom, for my Lord, the king, for the Lord has delivered you this day. All these events are now interpreted. The flip side of God intending to harm Absalom was God intends to deliver David. Friends, this is good news. The death of a rival, right? The throne is safe. The kingdom is secure. This is bad news. This is the death of a son. More to the point, this is the death of David's third son because of his sin in chapter 11. Recall the very first, the infant in chapter 12, verse 19. Then Amnon in chapter 13, and here Absalom in chapter 18. This is not the point, but if you're a New Testament Christian reading the Old Testament, I hope you see this. God's salvation and his judgment in the death of a son. Why I bring that up is God knows David's pain. Even if at the moment, David doesn't realize it. More importantly, God knows David's salvation, though at the moment, David cannot appreciate it. And trust me, if this is true for David in this extreme situation, it's true for you. God knows more about what you're going through than you could possibly appreciate or realize right now. In fact, the reason we can trust him is because he knows. Friends, the God of the Bible is not some aloof deity of religious piety by which we have to satisfy through sacrifice and good works, nor is he some impersonal concept like the universe that's not even aware of your existence. The God of the Bible came into our hurt, our pain, and our world, and he knows how often in this life, victories can seem like defeat. Just like his victory on the cross seemed like the greatest defeat there ever was. Of course, we know differently, right? God often uses our defeats to plant the seeds of his greatest victories, friends. It's no different in the biblical time. It's no different throughout church history. It's no different in our lives. And on this side of eternity, this mixture of victory and defeat are bittersweet. But trust me, on the other side, they're just better than sweet. Let's look at the last point our text has for us. A bittersweet end. I'm going to read it from verse 33. And the king was deeply moved. He got the report about the war, the battle. and Absalom's death. And he went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he wept, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." It was told Joab, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard that day that the king is grieving for his son. And the people stole into the city that day as people steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle. The king covered his face and the king cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son, Absalom, Absalom, my son, my son." Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, "You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines because you love those who hate you and hate those who love you. For you have made it clear today that the commanders and servants are nothing to you. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you'd be pleased. Now therefore rise and go and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." Then the king arose and took his seat in the gate. And the people were all told, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate." And all the people came before the king. Understandably, David is consumed with his grief and he buckles under the weight of it. There isn't a person here that would blame him. But he's not just a grieving father. He's the crown king and he has responsibilities. But we see David, he just can't hold it together. I don't know if you've ever seen someone in this kind of grief. It's hard. He can't hold it together. And Joab, again, this mercurial figure that I can't get into, rebukes him, verses 7, 5 through 7, telling him that his broken heart will cost him the crown, and that'll be a worse situation. So David pulls himself up by the bootstraps, so to speak, and he takes a seat at the gate. Our chapter, our text began with him standing by the gate, and it ends with him seated at the gate. And that's how we know this is one whole unit. And as verse 8 tells us, this is a good thing, right? It says, "Behold, the king is sitting at the gate, and all the people came before the king." Whew, national disaster averted. Civil War won, the nations held together. But you can only imagine how difficult this is for David. Even this great king has his limits, and every one of us does, and he buckles. His victory over Absalom seems more like a defeat. And as hard as it is, he must continue to put his trust in God for his own life and his plans for his people. Friends, if ever we were tempted to idolize David and put him on a pedestal, this chapter lessens that temptation. Now, I know you might say, no, it's chapter 11 with what he does with Bathsheba. But let's be honest. Most all of us would avoid and resist adultery, certainly murder. So even then, David's not really like us. He's still a little bit unreal. But here, a discouraged leader, a heartbroken father, a deflated saint who just... He says he has to go on simply because he has to. I think we can relate to that. David's won, but I bet if you were to ask him, he would say he's lost. It's bittersweet. Maybe, friends, there's a reason why at the last. The Bible says it's God himself that wipes away every tear from our eyes. Because in this kind of broken world that is complicated and it's hard, nobody, as we can see, if King David can't do it, nobody has the strength, the wisdom, the power, the compassion, or the courage to bring true justice and righteousness to all. But God does. God is the grieving father that grief cannot consume. He is the king always sitting at the gate. He always acts in concert with his fatherly heart and his kingly crown. And if we're honest, oftentimes we cannot see what God is doing and how he's going to bring about his promises in our lives. And we try to intervene. And what we end up doing is make matters worse every single time. In a passage like this, sometimes it's not that helpful, if I'm being honest, because it's scary. Because we see here clearly God's blessings did come, but they came in victory and defeat. And what we kind of want is just the victory part, and I can leave alone the defeat. But in a world that's broken by sin, that's not how it works. The two are not mutually exclusive. But friends, can I suggest to you, maybe that's not something we should be so afraid of. Our joys mingled with our sorrows, our good times tempered by the bad. Our highs could be higher if our lows weren't so low. But the opposite is also true. We can't forget that. Nor can we be a people defined by one and not the other. What do I mean by that? I mean, to forget our griefs and sorrows, we run the risk of being a shallow people without much depth. But to forget our joys and victories, we run the risk of being a bitter people without much hope. And can I suggest to you, in a world that's so fundamentally broken, it is our sorrows that make us relatable. And it is our joys that make us remarkable. And we have to have a gospel-centered view of both of those, as we see being lived out here in our text. Finally, one last word of encouragement. The story, our story, my story, your story, it doesn't end where the world tells us it ends. Let me read to you where it truly ends. When John says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." Whew. I know I'm running late, but let's sit on that. I still remember seeing my wife come out of the car. We got married like at Corona Del Mar Beach in front of some people's homes on a sidewalk. So she came out of the car, though, and I saw her, right? You guys remember that? It's beauty. It's a picture of perfection. It's a picture of all your longings satisfied. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning nor crying nor pain anymore." Why? "The former things have passed away." And he who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I'm making all things new." Our study of Samuel, I'm going to end with this, has been a study of history, but it's unique. We're not just studying a nation, people in the Middle East thousands of years ago. We're studying the human drama that the Bible records, and it begins with the words, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth," and it ends with the same words, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth." And it ends with a father, coincidentally enough, who is a king, coincidentally enough, who wipes away every tear and makes it all new. Like I said, in this world, it's just bittersweet. But when he consummates its kingdom, man, it's better than sweet. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to this message from Christ Community Church of Laguna Hills. For more information and resources from Christ Community, visit us at www.ccclh.org.